are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? 14 days and counting? Well, the new grim news about Obamacare premiums cut into Clinton's lead. We'll talk about that. Inspiration to Action Challenge, and we'll take on one of the big topics at the core of this race and the disenfranchisement of the American electorate, talking about economic inequality with an author and activist who has some solutions that may surprise you. That's coming up in just a couple of moments. I'd also love to get you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Tuesday, October 25th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. You know about our 24/7 Twitter tango, so chime in when it works for you at AB Writes. The show today being brought to you in part by Old Navy. Fall in for great style and savings at Old Navy. Also by PopNet, it's arts, culture, and conversation on air, online. PopNet features select editions of the Amy Beth Arkley Show. And our social media maven Aurora reminds me the Facebook page is also open. Please enter your comments during the show under the promo. So let's welcome Chuck Collins to the show. He is a senior scholar at the Institute for Public Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org, and the author of a compelling new book called Born on Third Base. Chuck is not a man who just talks the talk when it comes to economic equality. He is also someone who has walked the walk, born on third base indeed, one of the members of the 1% Club. He was, in fact, an heir to the Oscar Mayer fortune, and at the age of 26, decided to do something that a lot of people would never consider doing. He gave away his inheritance. Chuck Collins, welcome to the show, and congrats on this great book.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be with you.
Glad to have you here. Let's talk about your compelling story, because this is certainly a remarkable thing that not too many people in your position would have done. But you were working at a young age, in your 20s, with some folks in a mobile home park in Massachusetts as a community organizer or activist. And these folks had a serious economic plight. You watched them overcome it together as a community. You did some soul searching, and you decided to pretty much, I guess, give away your inheritance or decline it. Tell me how that came about and what were particularly your family's reaction at the beginning of all that.
Well, it was a powerful experience that you described, which was, you know, here I was at age 26. I probably had four or five times as much wealth as all the 30 residents in this mobile home park combined. And yet they taught me a lesson about what it means to pull together. And I sort of felt like that was a sign, you know, that that real wealth comes from people working together in solidarity, and that this money was kind of a barrier in my making my own way in the world. So, yeah, I wrote to my parents, and I told them my thought, which was to give away the money. And, you know, I had a good conversation with any, you know, like you can imagine with any parents. They're like, well, are you going to do something stupid, and are you going to do something that will risk your future security? And, you know, my response to that was, well, I'll be in the same boat as everyone else I know, I guess, and I'll have to get help. So
your dad was concerned, because he said, you know, you're right. Your dad pretty much particularly said, you know, you're young now and it sounds good, but, you know, as you get older, things happen. You have a family. If somebody gets sick, God forbid. I mean, did you think about that? Does have any kind of, you really had left yourself with no safety net? You just, what did you do with the money? You gave it to charity, or you just declined it to the rest of your family?
I did. I gave it to charity, and I kind of effectively was disinherited. But the good news is, you know, I kind of had a community of people that I knew. I sort of felt that it was a bit of a leap, but actually in retrospect, it was a much smaller leap than I thought, because, you know, I have all this other advantage that just comes from being white and privileged and having been in a family for four generations that has sort of social networks and, you know, all kinds of ways in which I had a head start, if you will. So, so it wasn't a huge risk, and, you know, but it's, it is
important. You didn't lose the foundation. You didn't lose the foundation or the network, which is something you do talk about in your book a lot, about how people, you know, it looks like people start out equally in school or something, but then how the divides become greater and greater as you go along with kids because of the advantages they have. You talk about your own hometown of Bloomfield, Michigan, which I think you said is one of the richest towns in the country, and you were almost embarrassed by where you came from for a while. And talk about that and how the advantages that people young people being brought up there find themselves experiencing versus what happens to people who have from lower income families.
Yeah. Well, one of the benefits of growing up in a wealthy community, and I can contrast that now to living in a large urban area, is there's a lot of wealthy people around with a lot of property that needs to be taken care of. So if you're a teenager and you're willing to work, there's a million lawns to be mowed and hedges to be clipped and pools to be cleaned and dogs to be walked and on and on and on. There's a full employment act for teenagers if you want it. And that's an advantage, you know, that you learn work skills, you know, and you learn to negotiate with your neighbors about money, but you're also in a place where you can make a mistake and it's somewhat forgiven. And I think it's a great advantage that we don't always talk about.
And there's also a great networking where people, and also some of these kids don't have to work, so they can get internships, which give them a leg up when it comes to actual careers down the line. Whereas you talk about the kids at college.
I try to catalog all these advantages, you know, which are just from the day you're born or probably before. School readiness and college readiness and workforce readiness. And as you say, Amy Beth, you know, if you can get an internship where they're not paying you, but it's in your field of study and you can develop some skills there, you know, a third of new hires come from people, you know, companies hire people who intern for them. It's like a huge leg up. But if you have to work, at a fast food restaurant to basically pay off your college loan or while you're in college, you don't get to have those leg up experiences. So there's just so many ways we underestimate all the ways that wealthy parents, affluent parents help their kids get a way head start.
And people don't really even think about it. When you're in it, you know, you take it for granted in some ways. And if you don't have it, you just take for granted it's not the right word, but you just assume you're not going to have it and you just have to fight against it and you have to work harder. And it just seems go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think you're right. I sort of confess to all these times not realizing just how big of a wind I had at my back and thinking, well, sure, everybody else had these opportunities, but they're not taking advantage of them. You know, you hear wealthy people say that all the time, privileged people, white people, you know, why is it that, you know, I have these opportunities, other people can do the same thing, and you realize that it's not that, you know. They're very, very different experiences.
I think you just hit something very important. Hit on something very important because I think that's where there's a big disconnect between the so-called haves and have-nots. Because a lot of people who are, frankly, frustrated and feel disenfranchised don't think that people who have all these advantages acknowledge these advantages. I mean, that's part of the problem with somebody like a Donald Trump who says, you know, I started out with a small $1 million loan and built my company into this, maybe, you know, whether he's exaggerating or not, a multi-billion dollar enterprise. The idea that even Romney was like that too, the idea that you can just borrow, I think one of his commencement speeches he gave during his cycle was, well, if you can't find a job, just borrow 30 grand from your father, your parents, and go start a business, as if most people could do that. So there's a sort of disconnect that some people who are very wealthy have. They don't realize what the average person has to go through in this country. And the idea of, you know, is the American dream still attainable? A lot of people, that was the big thing that America always had going for it. You start with nothing and you could become wealthy if that's what you wanted to do. You could do anything. Now a lot of people really feel that it's, you know, it's not so easy to do anymore. I don't think we can say it's dead. I don't think it's ever going to be dead. But it certainly is kicking and screaming a little bit now, don't you think?
Well, it is definitely true that social mobility is declining in the United States. I think you're pointing to something that I really, in this book, really try to talk about, this myth of individual achievement and not seeing all the help. And I really encourage people who have advantages to sort of talk about them without any kind of embarrassment or shame, but just say, look, you know, my family helped me in this way, or I got a government subsidy to do this. Because otherwise we do have the Donald Trumps and the Mitt Romneys and others who kind of get out there. They have these mountains of advantage behind them. But they still want to tell their story like they're self-starter bootstrappers, you know, who got there on their own. And that's a problem, because then you're judging other people. The corollary of that is, hey, what's the matter with you, you know? You didn't get that $30,000 loan to start your business. You know, it's like... It projects onto others the sense of like, oh, you can't, there's something wrong with you if you can't get to where I am.
Yeah, exactly. So So I think if people are just honest about it, like you said, you don't have to be ashamed of your wealth. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy. There's nothing wrong with being born on third base. And not everybody has to do what you do, which is admirable. And for some people, it would be shocking to actually give it all away. But to use it in a way that helps other people along the way as you're living your life is a good thing. And also to acknowledge it. There's nothing wrong with acknowledging that people helped you, I don't think. Because nobody gets there completely by themselves. And truly, there are people that are more self-made than others, but the people who pretend they are, I think, rankles those who are not in that position, I suppose. But you also say, you know, it's not completely just purely altruistic. It is to the advantage of the really wealthy people to want to have a thriving middle and working class and want to see other people move up the ladder, so to speak. Talk about that and why you think there is this kind of almost, I don't know if I want to go so far as called class warfare, but there's a lot of distrust and animus brewing out there, and you know that, obviously, from the work you do.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we're living at a time of extreme inequality, and if you look at kind of where we're going, where are, you know, if the rate of wealth concentration keeps growing, if the racial wealth divide keeps growing, we're basically moving to like a hereditary wealth an aristocracy, you know, a kind of economic apartheid society. And there's all kinds of research now that shows that that's not the kind of society you want to live in, that even it's not a good place for anyone, including wealthy people. It slows down economic health and growth. It undermines public health. It leads to breakdowns in social cohesion. And as you referenced, you know, this polarized politics that we're living through is a function of an unequal economy where people are angry, fearful. They might blame different people. They might scapegoat people. It creates a sort of ugliness in the culture. So that's what we're living through, and it's all it's the result of these extreme inequalities. So that's my – as I go out and talk to kind of wealthy business groups and wealthy philanthropists – you know, my argument is, hey, you know, you step up. We need you to step up because these inequalities are really bad for you personally, yes, as well as everyone else.
Now, are you turning people around? Do you see people? I know one of the phrases you use in the book is for the wealthy to come home. In other words, come back to communities, invest in communities, and not just isolate themselves and have, like, you know, wealthy enclaves. Do you find people are embracing these ideas? Do they see some sense in it, or are you getting a lot of pushback?
Yeah, I think there's a segment of what I would call the reachable wealthy, who are folks who, you know, they're not like the Koch brothers. They're not out there, you know, using their money and power to build a diabolical network to take over the world. You know, they're basically seeing, they're just looking out and saying, God, these inequalities are starting to be, you know, pretty unseemly. It's affecting people I know. It's not the kind of environment I want my children and grandchildren to live in. And so by inviting them home, what I mean by that is to say, you know, bring your wealth and your connections and your stake in the good and put it down in a place and come out from the gated communities and gated hearts and work toward, you know, fixing these grotesque inequalities that it is in your self-interest, but it's also, it's more, you know, it's the kind of society we want to live in. I think people are kind of waiting to be engaged at a different level on this.
They want to be invited, maybe. Is that what it is? They want to be said, hey, we need you. Come help us.
Like a lot of us, we don't know what's the most meaningful way to fit in, or we don't want to, you know, actually impose ourselves. But when I say invite, I mean, I think that's, you know, for everyone else, it's saying, well, where do we need wealthy people to step up? And, you know, where do we find them, and what congregations are they members of, and how can we actually break bread and have conversations about what's happening and what's happening in the future and how we can all together intervene in that? And I kind of give in this book a lot of ideas about, you know, well, what does that look like if you're wealthy? It's advocating publicly for fair tax systems and investments in education. But it's also like telling these true stories of advantage in a way that kind of debunks the myth of meritocracy, the myth of deservedness, which in many cases is what justifies these inequalities.
So for people to come out, you know, from behind the shadows and as you said, just admit your advantages and not be embarrassed by it. There's nothing wrong with it. But at the same time, don't hide behind some myth that you created that you were a self-made person or you did everything all on your own. I think that's a good start. And it's a good way to sort of curtail resentment. How did it get so out of whack, though? You know, you do talk a little bit about that, too, I guess, in the book. But, you know, there was a time when the American dream seemed to be on more track where people felt there was always rich and poor, of course. But
yeah,
there seemed to be more attainable. And even the wealthiest people, like the CEOs, they always made more money than the average worker. But now they're making 300 times the amount. I mean, at what point is greed so... you know, greed gone wild. I mean, at what point did we get to this point where it's not curtailed in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can go back and look at the late 70s, early 80s as a culture shift where the kind of values of individualism started to rise above values of community and, you know, support for one another and sense of solidarity. But, you know, there were powerful, wealthy corporations and individuals who used their power to rig the rules. And now I know we're using that phrase a lot lately, but, you know, essentially change the rules that govern the economy, tax policy, trade policy, government spending priorities, to benefit the already wealthy at the expense of wage earners. So, you know, wages have been flat or fallen really for almost over three decades. We've seen a slight bump up just this in the last year, which is good news. But we're talking about a long-term trend of growing inequality, and that's essentially what we have to reverse. And it's entirely doable to reverse it. And we can use some of the playbooks that existed after World War II, 1945. We taxed the wealthy, and we invested in debt-free education and low-interest mortgages for first-time homebuyers, almost entirely white. But we put millions of people on the fast train to the middle class, and that was a good thing.
And are these things doable today? And do you think that the people who are running for president, for example, now are talking about it in an honest way? Because the plans seem to be, or people have a vague notion of these plans, and part of it is on the electorate, frankly, because people don't do their research. They look for buzzwords, they hear something, they glom onto something that, you know, Donald Trump says, and then they don't look to see what his policy really would do and how many economists said it's really not going to work the way he's claiming it's going to work, for example. I mean, what can we do about that, too? That's up to people. It's up to all of us to our...
Yeah, absolutely.
Our.
I mean, I may think that the Donald Trump would be sort of the status quo, if you will, which is give more tax breaks to the very wealthy, disinvest the public sphere. Although both candidates talk a lot about infrastructure, which is a great example of, you know, we've sort of been neglecting our roads, our bridges, our public infrastructure. And if we actually focused on investing in that, that would create really good jobs and livelihoods for millions of people. It would meet a really strong need for public goods. You know, but I think, you know, that neither candidate has really, I think, put at the center of what would it really take to just reverse these inequalities. You know, one thing is we could tax the wealthy and invest in low-cost or debt-free higher education as well as early childhood education. This is what Canada and Northern European countries are doing, and that's why they have more social mobility now than the United States. If you want the American dream, you're better off living in Canada right now, unless you're born wealthy.
Kind of sad if you think about it. Well, Hillary Clinton, to her credit, is doing some of that. I don't know if it gets drowned out. And of course, she got egged on by Bernie Sanders, which helped push her a little bit more into that realm. But Donald Trump has this idea that he puts forth to people, and the people he's speaking to and who seem to like him the most are people who are the most disenfranchised in many ways, people who feel they've been left behind. Working class, primarily white voters, seem to be gravitating towards him because they're buying his idea that he's going to change things and upend Washington and make a complete shift. But his economic policy really is very much like a trickle-down economics, right? I mean, it's not really going to do what he's claiming he's going to do for people.
It's a complete recast of the trickle-down theory. You know, we're going to cut taxes for wealthy, we're going to cut taxes for corporations, and somehow that's going to, you know, generate investment that will...
We tried that. It didn't work too well, right?
Lift up the floor. It's kind of been the playbook for 30, 40 years now, and all we've seen are compounding inequalities.
Exactly.
And, yeah, I think it's true that candidate Clinton would basically say, you know, look, we got to maintain and expand the progressivity of the tax system. She's for closing a lot of the loopholes that corporations use and wealthy families use in their, you know, creation of these trusts. So that's exactly moving in the right direction. We have to restore the progressivity of the tax system. And we also have to invest in big things that make a difference for people. I mean, we've kind of gotten out of the habit of thinking we can depend on government for anything, and that that's part of restoring the trust that's broken at this point.
So why do you think people gravitate to Trump? I mean, I'm always trying to figure this out, because this is a guy who has always been rich, took advantage of people, kind of screwed over contractors and little guys and business people along the way, along with all his other nonsense that he with women and minorities and everything else. But, I mean, why do people, his message seems to resonate. I guess it's the blame game that he tries to put on immigrants. He's doing all that nationalistic kind of stuff. And the people that really would be helped by more of the Bernie Sanders, now Hillary Clinton agenda are very much in his camp, it seems. So what do you attribute that to? It's just
a segment of them. You know, actually, I've kind of been looking at the demographics of the Trump supporters. They're much more affluent than we think. But the reality is, white working class and largely rural communities have been left behind. They've been hurt by trade policies. They haven't benefited, just like everybody. The real wages have been flat, and the middle class standard of living is collapsing. So then the question is, who do you hold responsible for that, and what do you do about it? And, you know, actually Arlie Hochschild wrote a terrific book called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And the deep story she tells is this is how people look at the world. They're standing in line, and she spent 4 or 5 years with the Tea Party in Louisiana interviewing people. People feel like they're standing in line for the American dream. The American dream is just over the hill, but the line is not moving. In fact, it's stalled out. And other people are cutting in front of them, and the liberal elites, the Barack Obamas, are letting people cut in front of them, and they're laughing and making fun of the white working class and calling us racist and stupid. And Donald Trump comes along and he says, I see you. I see you standing in line, and I'm going to make America great again. I'm going to get the line moving. And, you know, there's something wrong. One thing that's wrong with that is there's a lot of people of color, obviously, standing in that line, too, who also are waiting patiently. And we need to get the line moving again. And Donald Trump, his program is not going to get the line moving again. It's not going to grow wages for the bottom. It's not going to create opportunities for people who have been left out.
Yeah. Well, that's why people, it is incumbent on everybody to be an informed part of the electorate. You got to do a little research. You got to go beyond the slogans and the big talk and the bravado and all of that. And I hope people do that, because
you know, and I totally get that people are angry. I think it's understandable that people are angry at elites. I mean, this happened a century ago. The last time we were this unequal, we had both the progressive farm populace, but we also had the rise of the Klan and the know-nothingism, anti-immigration movement. So people are, when they're angry and insecure, they're susceptible to scapegoating theories, you know. Oh, let's blame those new immigrants. Let's blame those people of color over there. They're taking our jobs. Well, go a little bit further into that story, and you'll realize those folks aren't benefiting from this economy either. And every time somebody tells you to blame a person who's more vulnerable than you, I would hold on to your wallet, because somebody's about to pick your pocket.
And obviously, when things get that bad, that's also not good for the wealthier people, because you don't want to start this revolution and they're going to come after you at some point if people get mad enough. So, so it's not completely altruistic or community minded. It's also self serving to have a thriving middle class, to have everybody benefit. So that's an argument you can make to your wealthier, reachable wealthy people.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and one of the Patriotic Millionaires Network, one of our members, Nick Hanauer, has been out there saying, look, the pitchforks are coming, folks. If we just stand by and let these trends keep continuing, you know, some jerk buys a prescription drug hedge fund manager and jacks up the price 5,000%, you know, people are going to start breaking windows and smashing cars. And they're going to be justified, because the wealthy elites have stood by and allowed this to happen when they have disproportionate power to change the story and the trajectory.
You got to have, I would say they really have to, teach ethics in business schools too. You know, it's okay to make a profit. It's okay to make a nice profit, but do you have to gouge people at every turn, especially if things are life-saving, like the EpiPen situation or the AIDS drug that you were referring to. These people, they're making a lot of money anyway, and you're not going to, you know, if you're helping people, you're still not going to hurt your lifestyle, so why not? I just don't understand where morality goes out the window. There should be, you know, cause it could go side by side with, I'm not saying we should be all socialists, but side by side with capitalism. There can be a
You know, you are absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Amy Beth, to point at business schools. And I've spent a lot of time in business schools and talking to, you know, where programs are being training young business leaders. And it's really not on the agenda. It should be much more on the agenda to talk about, you know, what's going on in the society? How does this affect business? What's the role and responsibility of individual business leaders and companies and small businesses to fix this? And everybody thinks it's somebody else's problem. But it's the culture and values
that
are...
I was going to say, there's also not that social contract that there once was. You know, in the old days, you know, people used to get a job with one company after they graduated high school or college, and they would stay with that one company, and there seemed to be more of a social contract with, you know, company and employer, employee and employees of the company. Now people change jobs a lot, which is a good thing. I mean, that people should have options and change careers and all that. But there doesn't seem to be as much responsibility, certainly on the part of the business, to their employees, which I think leads to this big disparity. I mean, if you look at Walmart, I mean, if people are working full-time at a company like Walmart, and they still have to go on food stamps, there's a disconnect there. There's a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is a good example of, you know, the culture shift is you are on your own. You have to figure out retirement. You have to figure out your health insurance. You have to, you just are, we're all atomized now. There was a time when there was a little more of a social contract that, you know, I'll give you my loyalty and you'll show me loyalty and we'll take care of each other. And that definitely is one of the shifts that we're living through.
Tough times, but there are people like you out there trying to make inroads, trying to bridge the gap. And are you optimistic? Do you think you're going to see positive change? Do you see it happening on a daily basis now, or are you pessimistic?
I see a lot of changing, and I think if you look at Washington, D.C. and Congress, you can get easily discouraged. It's like driving into a brick wall. But if you look at the undercurrent of what's happening, where are people at? What do they want? What are their aspirations? If you look at the millennials who are taking on all this debt and are starting to wake up and become a political force, I think we're going to see a realignment. We're going to see some things pop up that we didn't anticipate in the next couple years. Young people stepping forward. You know, we know that, you know, 75% of the population believes that we should raise the minimum wage, that we should tax the wealthy and corporations should pay their fair share. When people are asked to describe the kind of society they want to live in, the characteristics are more like Sweden than the United States, you know. And so I think we're going to see a realignment in the years to come, in the short term.
And the politicians have to catch up, because what people are saying and what Congress actually enacts, including things like background checks for guns and things like that, seem to be lagging behind. But enough people keep stirring the pot, and enough people become active and speak out, things can change.
Yeah, I mean, we you know, we're living in a not a democratic moment, but we need to, you know, rev up our democracy machine. Our votes have been taken away from us. Our representatives in Congress are not representing us. So part of that is at the very local level. You know, who's running for Congress? Do they really reflect your real values and interests? And if not, then challenge them, run against them, or support a candidate who does run against them. It's that is part of democracy. And, you know, we're going to start to see lots of people losing their seats, even in 2 weeks from now, because of their failure to listen to the popular will. And that's how the system will ultimately realign.
Let's hope. Let's hope it realigns in the right direction. That's true. I'm getting skittish about the polls. I hope not. Let's hope not. But it could. And I always tell people, don't get complacent. Whatever the polls say, you got to get out there and vote and do your part. Well, you're certainly doing your part, Chuck Collins. Listen, thank you so much for joining us and all the hard work you're doing. Your new book is out. It's called Born on Third Base, available at the usual suspects, I guess, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores. And we'll post the link for you. Do you have a link, a website where you can get the book directly?
I recommend people visit our website, inequality.org. You'll see the book right there on the homepage, and you can link to that and learn more about the work that we're doing around inequality as well.
Terrific. Chuck, we'll do that. We'll post the link for that along with the link for the podcast when it becomes available. Chuck, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Amy Beth. Take care.
That's Chuck. You're very welcome. Thank you. Chuck Collins, details, of course, we'll post it for you after the show. It is the end of the Thorkley Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505, should you be listening live on Tuesday, October 25th.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? People gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run. But the revolution, it's finally the table are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare line, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. And finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. And finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution.
See you.
Show, Stacey Chapman, too, and talking about a revolution, indeed, when it comes to economic inequality. There's one brewing in this country, one way or the other. Thanks again going out to Chuck Collins, author of Born on Third Base. He really does walk the walk. Could you do it? I don't know. Give away all that money if you had it. Twitter feed at AB Wright. Sonia says, hey, another great interview, like that guy's style, and your rapport. We'll check out the book. All right. And Fritzy says, good to hear a rich guy in the trenches, looking out for everybody. Indeed, he's doing it. And we will post the details for you. You can find out at inequality.org, more details on Chuck's book and the work he's doing with the Institute for Policy Studies as well. There you go. When the show is ready for archive, all the shows are archived for podcasts. As you know, you can follow the Amy Beth Arquis Show at the Blog Talk Radio site, iTunes, NetNow, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Deanna Listen for select editions on the Arts Radio Network and PopNet. All roads lead back to the website, amybetharkaway.com. So could you give up all that money if you had it? People, it's the money that matters. There's Newman and Knopfler for Steely on the Amy Beth Arquis Show.
Of all of the people that I used to know, both never adjusted to the great big world. I see them lurking in bookstores, working for the public radio. Can the babies around stack on their back, moving chair for slow. I said I know it's a a fly wife inside it. Great big pool in my backyard. Another great big pool inside it. Saturday is funny and matters. Hear what I say.
Hand and mama always had hope, and me and my sister couldn't. If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
buy you furniture for your house.
Maybe a nice Chesterfield or an ottoman.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a K car,
a nice Reliant automobile.
And if I had $1 million, I'd buy you.
Up there and hang out.
Like, open the fridge and stuff, and there will always be food laid out for us with little pre-wrapped sausages and things.
Mm.
They have pre-wrapped sausages, but they don't have pre-wrapped bacon.
Well, can you blame them?
Yeah.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a fur coat,
but not a real fur coat, that's cruel.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you an exotic pet.
Yep, like a llama or an emu.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you John Merrick's remains.
Ooh, all them crazy elephant bones.
And if I had $1 million, I'd buy you.
Crafting.
Of course we would. We just eat more.
And buy really expensive ketchups with it.
That's right. All the fanciest Dijon ketchup.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy you a green dress.
But not a real green dress. That's cruel.
And if I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy you some art.
A Picasso or a Garfunkel.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy you a monkey.
Haven't you always wanted a monkey?
If I had $1 million, I'd buy your love.
$1 million, I'd give those Obamacare premium updates, right? Uh-oh, ouch. Taking a walk through everyday America with Sugarland and Newman and Knopfler. It's the money that matters. I'm wondering, as the news broke yesterday about Obamacare premiums going up, what, 25% or more in some places, if that's going to take a bite out of the Clinton campaign lead. We'll see what happens. Donald Trump trying to make hay out of it. Of course, he doesn't really have a solution. It's just going to be something new, repeal and replace. That's the drumbeat of the Republicans for 5 years. They have never come up with a real plan that would work. And Trump is doing much of the same. It'll be beautiful. It'll be huge. Do your homework. Remember, do your homework. It's incumbent upon all the electorate to do that, to dig in and see really who is going to make a difference. And, you know, it's a tough thing. And I know, I see my own premiums going up. It's happening. But what's the alternative, and how can we stem the tide, and can Clinton put a fix on it and work with Congress to do that, got to bridge that gap? And I kind of think she can do it. I kind of think she can work both sides of the aisle, ironically, the way Obama might not have been able to do and a way other people might not have been able to do. So give her a shot. We'll see what happens. Remember, complacency is not going to be the answer. Don't get comfy in the polls. You have to get out there and vote no matter where you live. We have to send a message and a mandate and get this thing rolling, because the Trump presidency, I think, would be darker, more dangerous days ahead. We'll see. And obviously, if it happens, we'll have to make good. We'll have to make do the best we can, as we always do in America. We'll survive, but let's not go down that dangerous road. That's my assessment anyway. I know some people agree with me. Some people maybe not so much. They're Trumpians among us, I know. Everyone wants to come out and talk to me about why Trump is has the right answer, but they're out there. We're going to do a quick we're going to session out a little early today just because I have to dash to a meeting, but I do want to give a shout-out to our Inspiration to Action Challenge success story. It's Philip in Monticello, New York, says, I'm writing on a memoir/autobiography. It has been a trying time and tough sledding, I'll have to admit it, but the challenge helped me focus, which gave me discipline, and also gave me the courage to dig deeper into some serious hard memories. So I thank you for that. It's tough go, but it does work, and I think it'll be worth it. Well, thank you, Philip. I appreciate the honesty in that, and I think it is true. It takes a lot of courage to write anything, especially personal stories. So congratulations on working through it, and keep going. Please keep us posted. If the Inspiration to Action Challenge has been working for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out because you deserve it, and I also think it helps spark other people, and I really do. So send me a message over at the website. It's AmyBethArkawy, ARKAWY.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed, and we'll give you that shout-out. Also, if you need some cajoling, we'll give you a push in the right direction with a creativity coaching counseling conversation. First one is always on me. Give me about 2 to 3 weeks to connect because we're kind of booked these days, but I will do so. Spend about a half hour with you, giving you the primer on the challenge, some other tips and tricks that can push you in the right direction and get you off on a more productive and creative road. I hope so. And while you're at the website, by the way, you can also peruse my stories, The Eliza Gordon Mysteries. Great time to delve into it, as the first one, Killing Time, takes place around Halloween. You can move on to the Mystery and Mayhem award-winning Dead Silent and the latest, Murder, She Tweets. All available for ebook and paperback from Cozy Cat Press. You can also check out some other goodies along the way and chime in about your guest suggestions, big story, and Forgotten 45 requests as well. Speaking of Forgotten 45, a slew of seasonal favorites coming up this Friday at our annual Spooktacular. Get ready for the Halloween season. Are you buying your candies? I always pick out things I like because just in case, and it's a big chance that not enough people will come by. So you got the M&Ms, the mini Hershey bars, if you like the Skittles or the Starburst, whatever you like. Get what you like because you'll be eating it after that, till Christmas, if you're lucky. I mean, I'm lucky. Here's a sampling. Let's enter a Halloween haunted house with Jumpin' Gene Simmons. And I don't mean the guy from Kiss. On the Amy Beth Arkawy Show.
I just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bell started ringing and chains rattled out. I knew I'd moved in a haunted house. Still I made up in my mind to stay. Nothing was gonna drive me away. When I seen something that give me the creep, had one big eye and a two big feet. Stood right still and I did the freeze. He did this roll right up to me. Made a noise with his feet that sounded like a drum. Say you'll be here when the morning comes. Say if I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna. Ain't gonna run me off. In my kitchen, my stove was a blazing hot. The coffee was a boiling in the pot. The grease had melted in my hand. I had a hunk of meat in my hand. From out of space, I sat a man. Pot, I began to shout. He He drank a hot coffee right from the spout. He ate the raw meat right from my hand. Drank a hot grease from the frying pan. He said to me, now you better run.
Don't be here when the morning comes.
See if I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna.
For Della, I'm Amy Beth Berkley Show and Halloween rockabilly style with Jumpin' Gene Simmons and Haunted House. It is Amy Beth Berkley Show. Thanks for joining us today. Another special thanks to Chuck Collins, author of Born on Third Base. Details at his website, inequality.org, will post it for you along with the podcast when it becomes available. And thanks for playing with us in real time. Don't forget the conversation is 24/7 on Twitter at AB Writes. You can follow our producer, Trudy Hart, on Twitter at Radio Trudy. And you can friend me on Facebook. All roads lead back to the website, amybetharkaway.com.
Showtime is over.
Yes, it is. We're wrapping up a tad early today, but I do want to thank you, of course, for joining us. We're going to leave you with another Halloween song as we get ready for the Spooktacular this Friday and all weekend long. October 28th through the weekend, you can join all your favorites, including the listener requests, in the mix on Blog Talk Radio, Mixcloud, and Stitcher. Leave you with one, a forgotten 45 for Renee, circa 63. It's Lord Such. Screaming Lord Such and Monster in Black Tights. Hey, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show.
The kind of eye that I like, with your wrinkled up chin, where the worms have best when you're in your best, my monster in black tights. You're everything a freak like I like. And if you say you won't run away, I'll untie your chains today. Oh, I love to see you hopping along. I've got three legs too, though it may seem ever so long. I like you best when you're in your best, my monster in black tights. You're everything a freak like I like. And if you say you won't run away, I'll untie your chains today. And I'll feed you, dear. And I'll take your cage away. Come on, my dear, my hideous little monster. Let's go for what is in the...